Good afternoon and welcome to Corporations and Democracy for the 25th of April, the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scalmanini with co-host Annie Esposito. The opinions expressed on Corporations and Democracy are those of our guests and the hosts and not necessarily of the management of Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Today, Annie and I are substituting for our rotating co-hosts who usually host Corporations and Democracy on fourth Tuesdays. They're both not available today, so they will host the programs in May. Fortunately, we have the opportunity today to discuss a new community rights organization just launched by our guest today, Paul Cienfuegos and colleagues. The new organization is called Community Rights U.S., which fits nicely with its web address. That's communityrights.us. Paul Cienfuegos is surely a familiar name to many listeners, having been active in the community rights movement not just for years, but for decades. He is a community organizer with a capital C. Paul has been working on peace, environmental, and social justice issues since the 1970s. In the mid-90s, he began to see the effort as holistic rather than as single issues, and he credits the work of Richard Grossman and POCLAD, that's the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, for that revelation. He says, "I realized that almost every issue I had ever worked on was a mere symptom of corporate rule." Since then, Cienfuegos has activated communities around the country, finding ways for people to assert local control. He's done countless workshops on community rights, including several here in Mendocino County. And he is now working full steam ahead on this new community rights organization. It's a community rights support organization called Community Rights U.S. So let's talk about that new organization. Paul Cienfuegos, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Hi, Steve and Annie. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Nice to have you back.
Yeah, thanks so much. I wonder if we should start at the beginning with an explanation on what's the difference between asserting community rights and enacting protective regulations, which has been the historical way to go about maintaining environmental protections.
Well, although 99.9% of environmental activism in the United States today focuses on either getting existing regulations enforced or strengthened, there's an ahistorical aspect, a mythology aspect to this strategy, which is really problematic, and that is that since the 1880s, when the whole regulatory system of law was first established in private consultations between the Attorney General of the United States and the leaders of the giant corporations of that period, which were the railroad companies, they came up with a system of law that was designed to look like a strong response to people's outrage at corporate harm, but actually designed to do very little to actually stop the harm. It was a period where we moved from prohibiting corporate harm through the subordinate corporate charters process that came out of the American Revolution, to regulating or legalizing or normalizing corporate harm. And as the Attorney General of the United States was quoted at the time as saying, the first regulatory agency, which was the Interstate Commerce Commission, was to, quote, be a sort of barrier between the railroad corporations and the people. President of Union Pacific Railroad Company, Charles Adams, said, quote, what was needed to solve the railroad corporation's problems is something having a good sound but quite harmless, which will impress the popular mind with the idea that a great deal is being done when in reality very little is intended to be done, unquote. And so the public was pacified with new laws that sounded tough but placed pretty much all discretion in the hands of regulators. And who ran the regulatory agencies? Well, of course, the experts in those industries, industrial leaders. And who wrote regulatory law? Well, of course, the folks who understood those industries, industrial leaders. And the system worked so well that fast forward to the present, and we now have a regulatory agency for every kind of corporate industry and harm. And so we're stuck in this feedback loop where it's almost like a casino, where we win occasionally in the regulatory arena, And so people keep going back and back over and over, as if this is our most powerful place to be. But in fact, when you allow a regulatory system of law to run to decide what corporations are allowed to do, what you're ending up doing is legalizing and normalizing an enormous amount of corporate poisoning, harm to workers, etc., as a normal course of doing business, rather than the people deciding, do we want these harmful activities in the first place? So we end up externalizing our authority as we the people, and we allow these unaccountable, unelected regulatory directors, agency directors, to make all these key decisions for us. And I think you just have to look around the country today and see what the outcome is when you allow your democratic processes to be exported like that.
And you can come up with a allowable parts per million of pollutants when, in fact, we don't want any.
Exactly. We don't want any. And, you know, what's really interesting is I've been helping groups around the country now for more than a decade to take the actual regulatory hearing process and kind of capture the energy of the regulatory hearing itself and turn it into a community rights teach-in. And it happened again. We did it in Salem, Oregon, a couple of years ago when the Oregon Department of Agriculture was trying to force canola seed growing into the Willamette Valley, which would have destroyed something like a $25 million seed industry, almost entirely for export. And the ODA, the Oregon Department of Agriculture, was ignoring the overwhelming testimony from Oregon farmers who were saying this is going to destroy what we're already growing there through cross-pollination.
This is GMO canola they wanted to allow there?
It actually wasn't specifically GMO. There would have been some GMO that came in, but it was the canola itself that would have destroyed the specialty seed industry. And we ended up having more than a dozen people testify in 2 or 3 minute segments, that's all you're usually given, talking about how the process itself, the regulatory process itself, was a political fraud because it violated we the people's right of self-government, our right as the people of Oregon or the farmers of the Willamette Valley to make those decisions directly. And we kind of just, we captured the energy of the hearing, and we had our own signs about corporate rights versus community rights, et cetera. And it happened again just a couple of days ago. I led a workshop in Winona, Minnesota in March, and a woman named Katie Groves, who lives in Sparta, Wisconsin, came to my weekend training and talked at the training about this horrible destruction of a significant wetland that was going to be taking place after one of these so-called public hearings of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are all such misnamed institutions, right? The Department of Natural Resources in Wisconsin is, you know, given the authority to destroy natural resources.
Sounds intentional to me.
Yeah, I mean, this is all part of the system of law that's supposed to tie us up in knots and confuse us. And can I just read you a short segment of what she said?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's really exciting when we use these processes to educate the public. She said, watching the national and statewide news over the past 3 months and really 10 years, it's never been clearer that the so-called environmental protection agencies are not so much interested in protecting our communities and our residents as much as they are interested in economics and finding ways to permit and regulate harm. Specifically, they get to decide how many micrograms of crystalline silica per cubic meter of air a corporation is allowed to dispense into our air, how many micrograms of lead per deciliter a corporation is allowed to dispense into our water, how many millions of gallons of our precious and finite groundwater is allowed to be pumped, polluted, and returned to our water table. Why do we, the people, allow corporations to harm us, to pollute us, to poison us? And this was her two-minute testimony at a public hearing with, again, allies holding signs that reframed the problem so that people in the audience started to, by the way, not a single person among the public came to support the destruction of this wetland in order to build a frac sand mine. But, of course, the mine's going to be approved anyway because that's how the system works.
Right, yeah. We've worked on so many different issues, both environmental and social justice, but you have found a common problem in all of them that links this all together, which would be corporations.
Which is really a crisis of democracy. I mean, we don't have a clear-cut crisis. We have a democracy crisis. We don't have a GMO crisis. We have a democracy crisis. We don't have a nuclear power and nuclear weapons crisis. We have a democracy crisis, right? We have the wrong people making decisions. We have the corporate leaders empowered through the Supreme Court with their decision-making authority literally protected as a corporate property right of a corporate person, so that corporate directors, corporate boards of directors, literally get to make virtually all of the key decisions in the United States that affect all of us. What is going to be produced, how it's going to be produced, what are going to be the side effects of the production, how money is going to be invested that comes out of the profits, right? Where that money is going to be spent. And all of these have become, thanks to U.S. Supreme Court decisions, corporate property rights protected decision-making processes. And so we just end up in this situation where we, the people, have virtually no authority to govern ourselves or to protect ourselves where we live.
However, doodly-doo-dee-doo, you have a new organization, right? Community Rights U.S.?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I have been, there has been for many years, I can back up a little bit. So in 1993, the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy was founded by Richard Grossman and others. And they trained me to lead workshops, and starting in 95, I started leading intensive workshops. In 1999, a group of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund shifted from doing regulatory law work for communities to creating this new community rights ordinance process where you're actually writing laws that enshrine the inherent right of a community to protect its own health and welfare, and to strip corporations of their so-called constitutional rights. And that group has been doing some very impressive work since 99. And I've worked on and off with them and have ended up deciding over the last years that the country needs a second national community rights support organization, and that's Community Rights U.S. or CommunityRights.us online, because I think that there's so much potential for different kinds of groups offering different kinds of support to local groups that want to seize back their authority of self-governance. And so I'm very excited. It's a Portland-based national support organization for the movement with four Portland staff, including myself, and a group of a resource network that we're building that's going to be nationwide of people who can offer in-person trainings, consultations, webinars, etc.
Now, this is hot off the press, right? This was started weeks ago? Or is this...
Yeah, we actually have not had our official launch. We thought we would have it a few weeks ago, but we are fine-tuning the video. You know, these online fundraising campaigns like Kickstarter and Indiegogo all require a short and succinct and impressive video. Mm-hmm. To kind of excite people, and the video that we originally created was 7 minutes long, which was way too long, and it just didn't have the oomph that we wanted it to have. So we're reworking it and making it more like 3 minutes, and we'll launch in 2 to 3 weeks, we're hoping, with a major fundraising campaign where we hope to raise $50,000 to $75,000 over 30 days, mm-hmm. and to have a paid staff of four. But our website went up informally at communityrights.us a few weeks ago.
Okay, yeah, that's Community Rights U.S., and I like to say Community Rights Us. Also.
Exactly, and that's very purposeful.
That's .us.
Community Rights Us.
.us, yeah.
And in fact, if you look at the top of our website, the menu items are About Us, Learn With Us, Join Us.
So where do you think
Rights Us.
Mm-hmm. Rights Us. Where do you think we are now with community rights movement? Is it a baby still, or are we middle-aged, or what's happening? How are we doing?
That's a really interesting question. I think that it's having some growing pains. It feels like There have been some limits to what the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund has been able to do in the communities where it's working, and there's been increasing pushback in the courts. But there have been there's some very exciting developments that I want to share with you, all of you who are listening. Let me just give you a couple of fairly hot off the press stories. In the state of Oregon, 2 years ago, an Oregon State Constitutional Amendment campaign was launched by the Oregon Community Rights Network that would strip corporations from having the right to sue a local community that's trying to stop a corporate activity, a harmful corporate activity, which is part of the problem, is that these local governments have all these legal barriers to what they're allowed to do simply to protect themselves, to protect their health and welfare. And it was a right of local self-government constitutional amendment at the state level that the courts blocked 2 years ago, and just a couple of days ago, a court in Oregon reversed that decision and has secured the right of the Oregon Community Rights Network to move forward and to put this thing on the ballot. And I'll read you briefly something the judge said, which is pretty exciting. It's tempting to delve into the language and meaning of the right of local community self-government amendment. However, those are subjects for the citizens of Oregon to consider and debate. It's not for a few members of the executive or judicial branch to chill public discourse. The citizens of Oregon in their legislative capacity bear the burden of debating these issues and determining the course of action. Limiting, stopping, or redirecting discussion of this ballot amendment is contrary to and chilling of public political speech, unquote. And the press release goes on to describe what the amendment is. It would secure the right of local communities to move forward protections on the basis of health, safety, and welfare to a higher degree than the state. It would also limit the ability of corporations to override that right of lawmaking powers, which is very important. It would limit the ability of corporations to override our lawmaking power at the state or local level. The right of local community self-government would allow for the expansion of protections or the defense of existing protections if the state lessens these protections, but would not allow communities to adopt laws that would lessen already existing rights and protections recognized by state, federal, or international law. So that's very exciting, and signature gathering will start to happen now fairly soon in Oregon to get this on the ballot in November of 2018.
Now, clear this up for me. So it was filed 2 years ago or created or first proposed and somehow got hung up in the courts before it ever went to signature gathering?
Yeah, there's a two-tier signature gathering process in Oregon where you've got to collect, I think it's 10,000 signatures, just for the state to seriously recognize that it's going to be proposed as a state ballot initiative, and then it gets approved, and then you collect something like 140,000 signatures to get it actually on the ballot. And Oregon is one of only two or three states in the country where you can actually amend your state constitution through the ballot box directly by the citizenry. So in most states, only the elected officials can do that.
Yeah, so you're touching on something that we're all worried about, which is, so you go to all this trouble to get yourself a local ordinance that protects your local environment, and then it can be preempted by the state or the feds or some international trade agreement. So this is kind of stepping on that, I guess.
Well, it is, and I think there's two really very different ways to look at what we do when the state or the federal or the international global trade treaties slap us back and say, I'm sorry, you peons, you don't have the authority to protect your community from this intrusion by corporations. There's the legal angle where, you know, and that's, and I think this is where CELDEF really really thrives. I mean, it's a legal nonprofit legal foundation where they're using the courts to try to force these new rights into law. And I think one of the things, and we're very excited about this in Community Rights U.S. as well, but I think there's another option which we've been developing over the last couple of years as a kind of extra legal strategy, which is imagine that a community has passed a law, let's say, that bans clear-cut logging in the county, community, the county has passed this law. Mm-hmm. And let's say a logging corporation then files a lawsuit in the county court to say that violates their constitutional rights, their property rights, et cetera. Imagine if that community has gone through the necessary culture shift, which is the other half of what this work is about, which isn't really, I think people don't understand this aspect of the community rights movement as well. And I don't think that I've done as good a job of talking about it over the years. But in order to start to push back against these unjust structures of law and these higher levels of government that tell us that we're not allowed to protect our own health and welfare, as we the people, as the sovereign people, with self-governing authority enshrined in our state constitution and our federal constitution, imagine if people started actually breathing as, feeling as, thinking as we the people. Imagine if we, at the level of Mendocino County or the city of Portland, imagine themselves as having authority over their government with the right to reform, alter, or abolish their government as they see necessary, which is what most state constitutions talk about. And imagine if at the point that the courts, imagine at the point that that a logging corporation, for example, using that example, announces that it's going to sue to overturn a ban on clear-cut logging by corporations. Imagine if the people understand that they have the authority, they already passed the law already indicated that logging corporations no longer have constitutional rights within Mendocino County, you know, or another place.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, one of those constitutional rights that corporations no longer have because of the law that's been passed is standing in court. Legal standing comes with constitutional rights. You don't have it unless you have constitutional rights. And what's interesting is that all judges have the legal authority, independently, unilaterally, to declare that the party that is suing does not have legal standing. And so the court case doesn't even move forward. So imagine if Mendocino County's population, the people of the county, decide that we've already passed a law saying logging corporations don't have that authority. So we're not going to respect the judge if he or she moves forward to hear the case because the logging corporation no longer has standing in our courts because of the law that we've passed that strips it of its unjust constitutional rights.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to inform the judge of this fact, just remind them as a courtesy, not through spending tens of thousands of dollars in a courtroom to defending the law, but to simply remind them through a public letter or a full-page ad in the newspaper that we won't recognize the judge's process if he or she goes forward with the process because the party suing doesn't have standing anymore in Mendocino County. And that beyond that, we will use civil disobedience if necessary to make sure that the corporation never enters the county to do the clear-cut logging, again, because it's banned under the law we've already passed, and that it doesn't matter to us if the state or federal government are telling us we can't because the state and federal government are our legal subordinates, too. It doesn't matter to us if the global trade treaties that corporations signed to override our rights make the same claim that we no longer have self-governing authority, environmental protection authority, again, because all of those structures of law are violations of our rights and we no longer recognize them as valid.
Mm-hmm.
And none of this is controversial within our constitutional rights as we the people, but we've forgotten who we are.
Yes, indeed. Well put. So people just need to know that we have these rights and just never stop asserting them.
Right, and it's a collectivity process, right? It's not that I, as a, you know, we're so rugged individualist trained in this crazy culture in the United States, and we're so isolated, and we're so heavily propagandized that I think we are carrying a level of hopelessness and powerlessness as rugged individualists that we barely even recognize in ourselves. So there's a process of that Community Rights U.S. is going to be trying to create that goes beyond the workshops that I have been leading. We're in the early process of designing a whole new second weekend training called Becoming We the People, where we're actually helping people to imagine, to feel, to think, to breathe, what that actually feels like, what it looks like, what it tastes like for a community to start acting like and becoming we the people, because we don't even know what that means anymore.
So there's the resolve that people have to have, and they have to work in coalition and everything. But also there's a lot of things all around the country that people are working on, and I'd like to have you describe some of the array of things that are happening. And also we'd like to invite people to call in if you want to talk to Paul Cienfuegos with Community Rights U.S. and find out answers to your questions about what you can do where you are. The number in the studio is 707-895-2448. So I know that on your website there's a lot of stuff that happened right this month in April, some of it in Portland, surprisingly enough, where you are based. Portland agrees to end investments in corporations.
Yeah, we've had a committee of the city council that was empowered a couple of years ago to propose to city council corporations that the city should not invest money in, should not own stocks in. And its recommendations have been very controversial, especially around boycott and divestment movement around Israel and its apartheid policies. So it split the Jewish community wide open. It's just been a horrible mess. And so you've got, for example, the committee proposing to the city council to stop investing in Wells Fargo and Caterpillar corporations because of Israeli policies in the occupied territories. And the city was on the verge of ignoring these specific recommendations because of the culture war that's going on in the Jewish community in Portland. And instead, they did something really dramatic. They decided to stop investing in multinational corporations entirely. And it's the first major city in the United States that did this.
I like the sound of that one. It's great.
Yeah.
So their investments go into what other kinds of things, or how do they, what do they actually do instead of not do in this case?
Well, like most cities, they invest in the stock market. Mm-hmm. And so, they have, most cities have full-time people on staff who are monitoring their investments, mm-hmm. and making sure that they're making money for the city. Mm-hmm. And I don't actually understand the specific ins and outs of what is now going to change. So I wish I could answer that question better. But one of the other reasons that this happened is that we have an incredibly active climate protection movement in Portland. Portland 350, mm-hmm. pdx350.org, is one of the biggest and most active and militant climate protection groups of any major city in the United States. And they've also been pushing against many of the corporations that the city had been investing in. So I think for a multitude of reasons, the city has decided that they want to start figuring out how to invest their capital locally and not in the corporate corporate mm-hmm. system.
And was there something else also about addressing excess corporate salaries in Portland?
Yes. And I would have to actually access, you might be able to quote that faster than I can because I'm not remembering the details, even though it is on our homepage at the moment.
Oh, yeah. We just tell people to go to Yes Magazine and look it up. And then so talking about the different kinds of things that are happening, the first right to climate law passed in Lafayette, Colorado.
That's right. The first municipality in the state to recognize a right to a healthy climate for people and nature and to ban the extraction of oil and gas as a violation of that right. There have been right to climate community rights ordinances passed in other states, a handful of them, but this is a pretty exciting development. And also the right to a healthy climate was recently recognized as a federal constitutional right by Judge Ann Aiken of the U.S. District Court of Oregon. And that came out of the public trust doctrine work that's coming out of the University of Oregon's law school. in Eugene, that all of these youth and teen groups have been suing the state and federal governments of Oregon, Washington, and possibly other states and the federal government, claiming that their right to a climate future is being violated. And every one of these state and federal institutions has pushed back and tried to get the court case thrown out as frivolous, and every one of those has failed. So every one of these court cases is now moving forward and will start to be heard in courts later in 2017. The right to a climate. I mean, this is the paradigm shift in general that both the public trust doctrine movements and the community rights movements are focusing on, is that we have to get away from parts per million of, you know, let's negotiate with corporations to try to lower their toxic output into the environment, and start saying, we the people have the right to a healthy food supply. We have the right to clean air. We have the right to clean drinking water. We have the right to a climate. We have the right to a sustainable energy future, et cetera, et cetera.
Just to add a little more motivation to this issue, you might have seen in the news a few days ago, and if anyone hasn't heard that among our listeners, Mauna Kea hit 410 parts per million CO2 for this in recent weeks.
Yep.
For the first time. So it was huge news around the world when it hit 400 sometime last year, I think it was, and stayed there. Well, it didn't stay at 410, but it did hit it for some weeks, apparently. So the debacle on climate continues.
Exactly. And I think the situation is much more dire than even groups like the Climate Lobby and 350 are talking about. I mean, there are some scientists who are saying that 5, 10, 20 years from now, we may not actually have a climate that can support the life that currently exists on our planet because of the methane eruptions that are taking place undersea, in the Siberian tundra, et cetera.
Yes, in the tundra, that's
emergency situation.
Yeah.
Really does require, again, us to stop imagining ourselves as voting with our dollars or acting on single issues as activists, and to start imagining ourselves as the deciders, as we the people who need to respond in an emergency moment in our country and on planet Earth, and act as leaders and deciders, not pleading, not begging, but exercising our power.
Mm-hmm. Going back a couple of minutes, you mentioned the work being done at one of the universities there and the rights to climate by young people, children, frankly. Is there a reference to that, or is there a one place for listeners to go to, you know, monitor that and see what the news is from that on that issue?
There is a site, but I'm not remembering what it's called. But if listeners can put in public trust doctrine climate, you'll have all the news that you can handle.
Okay, public trust doctrine then regarding climate.
Climate, yeah.
You know, I'm wondering how much networking is being done around the country. You do workshops all over the place. And do you find groups linking together, like I noticed with the resistance movement? There's a lot of work to do outreach to each other. First, you ended up with a million different groups, and then you had them linking up with each other, and some of them joining the other groups, and so that they can multiply their effect. Do you find that happening?
The area that I'm really most excited about networks happening is in rural Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, where I have, believe it or not, been invited 14 times in the last 3.5 years to lead my workshops. There are now 21 counties in these rural areas of these three states where community rights movements have launched. None of them have successfully passed community rights ordinances yet, because none of these states have the ballot initiative, and so they have to get local elected officials to pass them. And in most of these states, it's quite amazing. In these three states, in the small rural counties and townships, you have situations where women have never once been elected to local office, where you've got the same families kind of running the town or county government decade after decade. And so this good old boy system is having to be broken up very slowly just to get the right people into local decision-making authority, into local office, so that a community rights ordinance can be passed in the first place. And so the work in many of these counties literally is waiting until the next election and getting their own people to run. And in about a half a dozen of these 21 counties in Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, they've actually successfully gotten their own people in office. And so they're starting to change the conversation. And in just a couple of communities in Iowa City, Iowa, I've been working intensively for 3 years with a group called 100 Grannies for a Livable Future. Absolutely amazing group, which is up to about 160 grannies now. 100grannies.org is their website. I encourage people to check it out. And they're working on a number of community rights ordinances at the moment. That two of them have been filed, one with the city, one with their county, and they might be the first folks to pass an ordinance, but in this region. But to get back to your question, I've helped them in the last 2.5 years to organize two regional gatherings, day-long events, where in both cases more than a dozen counties from these three states came together for a whole day to teach each other what's working, what's not working, to figure out who has which skills, who can share what with who. We're going to do a third regional gathering this summer or fall. And I think that that is really the future. And it's one of the big differences that I have with CELDEF, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, which tends to be very top-down in all of its organizing and teaching methodologies, rather than understanding that there is wisdom that can bubble up in all of these communities. And once communities learn these new community rights practices and strategies, that they can actually do the teaching of each other, for each other themselves.
You just reminded me of the mission statement on your website of the new organization, Community Rights U.S., that's to protect the rights of we the people and the natural world by dismantling corporate rule from the local up.
Yeah.
You just sort of just touched on one of the other questions that I was going to ask you is around the country. What kind of similarities do you find and what kind of differences? And I'm a little awestruck at how far some people have from the starting point, having to just, you know, break up an old boy network to even get the city council to even start to think about this.
Yeah. I gave a keynote speech at a conference in Columbia, South Carolina, a year and a half ago that was mostly, the audience was mostly black farmers, which was a really exciting opportunity for me to see whether does the community rights analysis, does the message resonate with rural black communities? And I was incredibly excited to discover it resonates just as well there as with progressives or rural people in the Midwest. And I think one of the things that I just heard a strange sound. You all still there?
Yes. The sound you heard is I just put someone that wants to ask you a question, I just put her on hold so that she can ask you the question when you're through answering this last one.
Okay. I just lost my train of thought.
I'm sorry. That's the funny things, the funny sounds in the studio will do to you.
I was going to say that, you know, I think one of the things that people are regularly wondering about our work that I am asked a lot is how does the Trump phenomenon impact, how has it been impacting the community rights movement? And I think that what's interesting about our movement is it's transpartisan, and it always has been. Most of the 200 communities in 8 states that have passed these ordinances so far since 1999 are rural conservative agricultural communities,
mm-hmm.
Pennsylvania, Ohio, New Hampshire primarily. And rural conservatives have always understood and respected and supported local control, whereas progressives tend to not trust local. Progressives have tended to go to the federal government and ask the federal government to create environmental laws that protect them from the local government or from their local constituents. It's a very interesting culture split that has happened over a long period of time.
Oh, that is interesting.
So, you know, now we're in this unusual situation where a reactionary force of far-right Republicans now controls all of the aspects, all of the parts of the federal government and a majority of state governments as well. And so you finally see progressives for the very first time in my activist lifetime of decades recognizing for the first time that the local has to be the place that they do their organizing and pass their laws to defend themselves from the federal.
That's,
so I actually think that it's an incredibly teachable moment for people from across the political spectrum to come together and recognize that everybody lives somewhere, and the point of defense that is most significant at this point has to be where we live.
Yeah, that's sustainability number one. We have a call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, this is Carol in Point Arena. You passed right by Siberia and the methane release.
I cannot hear you.
Would you please? Would you please explain why this is happening? And I will get off the phone.
Can I please explain why what is happening?
Why the methane releases in Siberia are happening? Yeah, she asked about that.
Yeah, thanks for your call. Appreciate your call.
I am not a climate expert. Understanding is that it's literally just the raise in temperature in the world that is triggering the raise of temperature caused by industrial civilization, creating the climate, the greenhouse effect, and that literally just a degree and a half plus of which is where we are now, is changing the chemistry both of the oceans and of the frozen tundra in Siberia to create this this mass release. And methane is an even more potent greenhouse gas than what we create industrially.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we have another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Annie. It's Anna Marie.
Hey.
Really good discussion. You know, I've been really wondering, and I'm at a loss on what's happened with the current administration and like gutting the EPA and gutting OSHA and gutting all these federal agencies. I learned from personal experience that these federal agencies are there as a shield to the corporations. Like, for instance, when you sue, when you have a really bad timber harvest plan, you don't sue the timber company. You sue, you used to sue the Department of Forestry. Now you sue Cal Fire, and the real party of interest is the Timber Corporation, and so they use our taxpayer dollars, Cal Fire does, to defend the corporation. Mm-hmm. And the EPA is the same way. I learned that during the PCB spill back in 1989. All the government agencies are like that. So I'm aghast at what's going on with the Trump administration, and at the same time, the part of me that's optimistic says, well, maybe he'll get rid of these things, and when we get a better president, we'll get real community-based organizations, or at least the community, you know, they won't be full of lobbyists, they won't be full of lobbyists and all that other, all the corporate interests the agencies want. So I'm wondering what your guest thinks about that. I'm at a loss.
So did you get that, Paul?
Yeah. It's an interesting question that deserves an expansive answer. I don't know whether she heard at the top of the hour me talking about these regulatory agencies and their history. But if anybody who missed that aspect, go online and look up an article called Sheep in Wolf's Clothing. Or you can also go to communityrights.us and put it in our search engine and you'll find it. Sheep in Wolf's Clothing, about the origins of the regulatory system of law in the 1880s. But, you know, what she's raising is a really interesting point. And, you know, tragically, if Hillary Clinton had won the presidency, we would have just had more business as usual with our regulatory system of law, which continues to defend harm. So there's a way in which Trump's rise to power is is opening up the possibility for a kind of discussion that has never existed in my lifetime, at least, where we start to come together as we the people and say, well, you know, the actual history of regulatory agencies is so-and-so, and they've never served us properly as the people, and they've never protected us environmentally. And regulatory agencies also limit the rights of working people, even though they're officially doing just the opposite. And so what perhaps Trump's dismantling of the regulatory systems of law, or at least massive defunding, is the opening that we've needed for decades to talk about what kinds of agencies do we the people actually want that would protect the environment, that would protect civil rights, that would protect the Internet and public equal access to it, that would protect working people, that would protect, you know, the forests and healthcare and everything else. So I think I think strangely enough, if we can, and again, this is such a big if we as single issue activists can rearrange the way that we think and act as citizens and start functioning as we the people and start questioning these larger structures, then we might end up post-Trump with a different kind of system of law that we've been agitating for over these next years that actually enshrines the right of local communities to protect themselves and govern themselves and enshrines a new kind of agency in the state and federal system of law that no longer has any participation by multinational corporations, where corporations' directors are not in revolving doors running the agencies, and the agency rules are not written by corporate officials, and we don't have a parts per million strategy for environmental protection. And so I think there might actually be a silver lining to the Trump catastrophe that's unfolding.
Oh, aren't you
nice? It'll require mass mobilization way beyond what's happening at the moment. And I'll say one last quick thing is we're going to be tackling that very topic in our next regional gathering in Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota of these couple dozen community rights counties. We're actually going to try to create a think tank on regulatory reform.
Right. We have a caller waiting to talk to you, but they have their radio on. That's rule number one. Turn your radio off.
Yeah, I did.
Okay, thank you. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for the discussion. This is long overdue. I attended a class at the College of Mendocino with the Tarbells from Casper, and we did Democracy and Corporations, and we took the moveon.org. And I'm concerned, it's on the same level of, you know, how do the citizens take back our government? And I'm thinking that a part of me is an anarchist, the withering away of the state, you know, when people have a consciousness and a development of inner, you know, right and wrong, that we don't need somebody over our heads to, you know, to dictate, you know, what that we have to abide by Section 6.43, Subsection D. If we could just do unto others as we'd have done unto us. And, you know, the simple bottom line is love one another and do the right thing. It shouldn't be so complicated that we have to go to court and spend millions of dollars, that the system is set up. I have a friend who says that we live in a critocracy, and that was a new word for me, and it means a rule by judges. And if you look at the way that the institutions have been set up, where you have the lawyers and the judges and the prosecutors and the defense, the prison system, the police, you know, 50% of our budget, probably more like 70, is going for oppression and killing. And if we the people were to take back our rights to govern ourselves and to do, you know, to be responsible, you know, how would we go about doing that? And I have a question. My mom wrote a paper on democratic centralism and the rights of the minority. For instance, if we have 1% or 2% of the population Native American, and if 50% of the people want to, you know, vote over, they still have rights, the rights of the trees, the rights of the fishes, the rights of the minority within the larger picture. And my mom did a 33-page treatise that was incredible. I wish I had it. But I remember she said that in the case of an emergency, of a flood or hurricane, you need to have centralism, where you need to have trustworthy leadership, you know, where it's guiding, you know, you can't question always what's being done. You have to follow. But ordinarily, the people are primary. The people have the wisdom on the ground level. They know which streams have which medicine plants.
Okay, let's get Paul's reaction to that.
I'm just throwing thoughts out for consideration.
Yeah. Paul, any comment?
Okay, thank you so
thank
much.
You.
Okay,
thank you.
I think part of what it means for we the people to start activating our own authority again, which we haven't done for so long, is to reimagine what even representative democracy looks like and feels like. And I just yesterday went to see an amazing new documentary called Tomorrow, which I hope can be brought to Mendocino County as well. And in it, there was a section on reimagining democracy, where there are now places in the world where they're not throwing out their legislatures, but they're replacing elected legislators that tend to get stuck there and make lots of money and be corporate supported with a system more like the way our juries work, where you actually have citizen legislatures that are picked literally through random
like a lottery?
A lottery, basically. And, you know, Ernest Kallenbach wrote a book called The Citizen's Legislature decades ago, the man who wrote Ecotopia, on this same topic. But it turns out, and I didn't even know this, that there's parts of the world where this is actually already taking place, where we still have a representative democracy, but we've got a rotating collection of we the people who are operating there. And in Iceland, you know, that's what happened when the massive bank failure happened in Iceland a number of years ago. The people mobilized and threw out their entire parliament and created a bottom-up process to rewrite the Constitution to make sure that the banks would never be allowed to centralize this kind of power again.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that there's so many different ways that we're so stuck in pleading with and demanding of power holders, you know. I mean, we're going to have yet another giant march this weekend, mm-hmm. and I love these giant marches, but they don't exercise our authority, you know, and we race through the streets shouting, this is what democracy looks like, and I go, no, it's not. This isn't what democracy.
Right.
We
Thank
wouldn't
you.
Have
yes.
to be tens of thousands of people strong defending science last Saturday in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
Around the world, if we actually had democracy, this is what a dysfunctioning system looks like, where we have to be in the streets.
Let me thank you for mentioning a word a minute ago, which was left out of the conversation up until then, and it's something that may be too big a tangent for this session today, but maybe another time I'd revisit this. You said the word jury. And the conversation is usually about judges this, judges that, and they, you know, they decide things or they overrule things, you know, penalties on corporations, this kind of thing. Where do juries come into play? And again, if that's too big an answer, we'll do another time. But
no, it's a great question, and I'm not an expert in this, and I'd like to learn more about it. But in too many of these cases, it's judges, not juries, that get to decide these community rights decisions, and mm-hmm. that's not okay.
You know, we're just about out of time, and we want to have a chance for you to give some of the details about Community Rights U.S., the new organization. But I did want to sneak in one more question, which is where do charters fit in? Because I know Mendocino County tried to get one, and it didn't pass. And if we had one, we might have been able to avoid a governor appointing a vacancy on our supervisors. Well, where do charters come in?
Well, so again, this is a bit complicated to lay out in a matter of seconds, but
sorry.
There are ordinances, city and county ordinances, in places in communities and counties that are not home rule communities and counties. And in communities and counties that are home rule, i.e. they have their own authority, their own mini-constitution, that's the home rule charter, they get to actually write their mini-constitution. And they get to take a community rights type law and turn it into an amendment of their constitution rather than a standalone ordinance. And in your county, you already have the authority to create a home rule charter. And I was part of the campaign down there last year that sadly failed by a few percentage points. But in the time that we have left, I don't know how much more to say. all I can say is people assume around the country that if you're a chartered town or city or county, you have all the authority you need to protect your own home, your own health and welfare through law, and that's actually not true.
Okay.
To pass the kind of ordinances that we propose or passed at the local level still violates these hidden in plain sight structures of law, corporate constitutional rights, state preemption, and Dillon's rule that make it literally illegal to protect your health and welfare locally. So becoming a home rule chartered city or county is a step in the right direction, but only one place in the United States, and that's Grant Township, Pennsylvania, has written a home rule charter, which has been passed and is now law, that from beginning to end is a community rights structured home rule charter.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I would also encourage people to Google Grant Township, Pennsylvania home rule charter, which will also be a document at some point soon, which will be available through communityrights.us.
Okay, thank you
but
so
community
much.
Community Rights US is to get all of these key documents in one location, which has never happened before in our movement.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Okay, thank you, Paul Cienfuegos. Communityrights.org.
.us,
excuse me. Communityrights.us, sorry.
Check it out.
And thank you so much for being with us. Coming up next, Rhino is going to be sitting in for Roots and All with some cool music.